We're talking with Orville Schell, who over the last few years, 10 or 15 years, has traveled in China a great deal and written a lot about it. He has written a number of books. His most recent one that we'll be talking about is entitled Discos and Democracy, China in the Throes of Reform. He's also written for magazines including The Atlantic Monthly, The New Yorker, Rolling Stone, and The New York Times. And his, as I say, has a number of books. Some of the titles of the recent ones, To Get Rich is Glorious, Modern Meat, Watch Out for the Foreign Guests, and In the People's Republic. And his writing is quite accessible. It's a pleasure to read. It is instructive without being overly didactic, and fun to read without being too breezy. I think it strikes just the right kind of note. I had the opportunity to talk with him a couple of years ago when he was here on the U of I campus, and we're pleased to be talking with him again this morning. I think you will find him an interesting fellow. The book is just recently out. It's published by Pantheon, and you might want to take a look at it if you're interested in the topic. And I think after our talk, I think that you will be interested. As we talk, you're invited to call in and talk with our guest if you would like. If you have questions or comments of your own, our telephone number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere in the state of Illinois. That is 800-222-9455. There, the exchange is the difference between the two. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. And Orville Schell is joining us this morning by telephone from San Francisco. Good morning.
Good morning.
I enjoyed reading this book as I have enjoyed reading several of your others.
Oh, wonderful.
I think it's really what I like about it, I guess, is that it seems to be a real sort of ground floor view in kind of a journalistic way, and yet it's sort of, I guess it's what they call in journalism, it's participant observation. You're sort of like in the middle of it and writing from that perspective, and I think that really gives one a feeling that you're really there. So it's quite nice. And I think one of the things that I thought about as I was looking at the book is that when you look at a country like China, where there has been such dramatic change, and say in the last, certainly in the last 10 years, a place where there has been so much change so fast, I think the danger is, or the difficulty is, that it's difficult to sort out the important change from the superficial change, and that we have this tendency, especially when we look at countries that we think are very different from our own, and I think we've done it with the Soviet Union and we do it with China. We go from these great extremes. We go from this point of saying that they are nothing like us, and when we see them moving perhaps a little bit in our direction, we change very quickly to say they are exactly like us. And for those reasons, that it's very difficult to sort of understand what are the important changes and in what ways they really are changing and what is, in a sense, just window dressing.
Well, I think particularly in regard to China, the United States has long had a very unique relation with that country. And in many respects, it's been a somewhat paternalistic one, too. You recall the turn of the century and up until 1949, the tremendous number of American missionaries that were there, some of them wonderful people, very selfless and very devoted. But always there was the imputation that we were there to save the sort of lesser Chinese soul for God, to help these benighted people. And I think in some respects this holds true today. We as Americans, I think particularly in regard to China, are quite thrilled whenever we see another country, or in this case China, becoming what we assume to be more like us. And we assume that they're becoming normal, that they're becoming, they're straightening out, sort of the prodigal son mentality. And I think in a way this does distort our abilities to see what else is sort of uniquely Chinese, what other accomplishments they might have attained as a traditional society, as a communist society. And it does make it, we tend to render the picture in some more simplistic terms. And so as we see China in effect being sort of overcome now with new ideas of, figuratively speaking, discos and democracy, sort of the sacred and the profane. We may think this is China. This is all China. Well, of course, we're really talking about trends here. We're talking about what's new, where things are moving. And we speak about China becoming reinfatuated with the idea of democracy. This is true. Young people, intellectuals, are now idealizing American democracy in a very notable way. But this doesn't mean that all of China is democratic, nor does it mean that it will be a very easy thing for it to become so. So I think you're correct. You have to kind of always look behind even the sort of newest metaphors, the newest sort of, what would you call them, slogan. China is a country that's been burdened for a long time by slogans which mask always an infinitely more complex reality.
Mm-hmm. Well, the book is really is about how things are changing in many different fields, so that I suppose this is a difficult question to answer. But if one could pick one or two examples that you felt were particularly telling about how things are changing in China, what might they be?
Well, let's pick one example from sort of the sacred and profane, the low and the high. Let's start with the low. One example which I think is very emblematic of the way in which the economy is changing, namely that China is rapidly switching over from a country that is dominated by state-owned businesses, in a communist sort of boilerplate-type enterprises, to private enterprise. Everybody is trying to make money. And many people are setting up their own businesses because they can do better, there's more freedom, they're not stifled by bureaucracy. And one very bizarre example of this that I ran into was a shooting range, which I write about, that was run by a branch of the military, and it was designed for foreigners to come out and shoot machine guns, anti-aircraft guns, anti-tank rockets.
It's an amazing story. Is it true that actually in the future they're planning on perhaps having some tanks there?
Yes.
So someone could actually sit in a tank and shoot the cannon off?
And blaze away at whatever. Yes, indeed. I mean, this is sort of... and really what this says, you see, is, I mean, it's who would ever have thought that we'd be in the People's Republic of China, you know, with the People's Liberation Army out there as Western imperialists and capitalists blazing away with their most, with some rather sophisticated weapons. But what's behind it? What's behind it is the open-door policy of Deng Xiaoping, which brings hundreds of thousands of foreigners to China. Foreigners want some fun. Foreigners have money. This is the other major sort of reform aspect of China, namely the liberalization of the economy, which means that not only private individuals can set up businesses, but even state-owned enterprises are trying to figure out a way to get in, get a bigger slice of the pie of this foreign hard currency. And since the government is no longer as ready and willing to subsidize all these enterprises, incidentally 20-odd percent of which lose money every year, they're out on their own trying to hustle. And so you get these rather bizarre and I think somewhat aberrant institutions being set up, amusement parks, bowling alleys, you know, luxury resorts, bars, nightclubs, I could go on and on and on, which are calculated to make money, not to be politically pure, make money. Well, this would be the first example, then, of the way in which things have changed. The economy has changed. People's mentality has changed towards a real fixation on wealth as the currency, not politics, not political purity, things like that. Well, on the sacred side of the wager, we look at the student demonstrations of a year and a half ago in favor of human rights, democracy, and freedom all across China. Students in 20-odd large cities rose up, took to the streets, demonstrating against the party and against the government, saying they wanted more democratic reform and they wanted it faster. This would have been unheard of in the past. And it came from, I think, you know, a combination of idealizing the West, an equal and opposite reaction to the way they had once reviled it, and also from a sense that, many of them had been abroad. 25,000 odd Chinese students here in this country now, whereas this past year there were 35 Russians. Well, this is a tremendous difference. They saw democracy. They felt what it was like to be free, to be in a state which was not controlled by a single party. And so the party in its own turn in China has recognized that if it wants to modernize, it simply must let its intellectuals have more freedom. Otherwise, they won't think, they can't create, there'll be no imagination, you know, either of an intellectual or technological kind, and the country will bog down. And so they, too, have talked about political reform and democratization. Mm-hmm. Well, so then you have the students taking to the street, and what happens? Well, any communist country with a one-party system is going to take a very dim view of this. But here you see, on sort of two sides, sort of opposite extremes, the way in which this country has changed, the way in which it's being reanimated by new ideas, it's being opened to the West, it's putting money rather than politics in charge, it's stressing production, and we see, in essence, a real collapsing of the old order.
That's very, very interesting. What, one might think that that with the kind of momentum of change that we've seen, that that means that the Chinese leadership is of one mind about where things are going, and I would think that that is not the case.
Well, no, it certainly isn't, and we might also remember this when we, as we watch the Soviet Union now. I mean, just as China has been severely divided over the past 10 years between those people who do believe in reform. You know, they're good communists, they believe in the party, but they also believe in reform. And on the other hand, people who have spent maybe 50, 60 years fighting for Mao's revolution. Maybe they've lost family members, they've had friends killed, who people sacrificed, they've had rather Spartan lives. They're not about to see Mao's revolution just thrown over by a bunch of upstarts who want to worship capitalism, imperialism in the West, and they form a bloc. Maybe they're in favor of some reforms, you know, let's decentralize the economy a little in order to get it going. But they're certainly not in form of students in favor of students demonstrating. They're certainly not in favor of, you know, this disco craze that swept the country, and which in a way is a whole sort of cultural set of values as well as just dancing. I mean, it involves fashion, it involves individualism, it involves a kind of narcissism, it involves a whole renaissance of sort of sexual relations between young men and women, which, you know, in effect comes with the dancing. So you find these two factions struggling, not just for control of the party, but for the minds of the Chinese people, over what kind of a revolution this thing is going to be that goes on in China. And the Soviet Union, we see the same thing. Gorbachev, avidly, fervently believing in reform, running into people like Ligachev, who have a much more modulated notion of what should happen in that country and do not want to see everything that his revolution has fought for over the past half a century or more suddenly transformed and thrown away. And there are a lot of people in each country, party cadres, party officials, who have a very substantial vested interest in things staying the same. So it is a misnomer of the most grievous proportions to say that communist countries are controlled by one tyrannical dictator who throws a lever and everything moves. It's not true. There has to be as much jockeying and manipulation and persuading as there is in any democratic country.
Mm-hmm. You talked a moment or two ago about the wave of student activism, and particularly, I guess, was this particularly in 1986?
Yes, and then when it went on into 87 when there was this big counter-reaction, sort of the what you might call the hardliners, or, you know, old-line Maoists, against all of this Western culture coming in and against much of the reform movement itself.
What you write in the book, and would you say that there are a couple of things that you think are really significant about this wave of activism and the way the government responded? One is that the relatively cool way the government dealt with trying to dampen it down.
Yeah.
And the other is the fact that it sprang up so spontaneously. And that, and when you talk about the sort of motivation of the students, you get the impression that some of them weren't really quite sure what they were demonstrating for, or at least that maybe they weren't all demonstrating for the same thing. And it all, you know, it all makes one wonder that in the Chinese context, when they use the word democracy, what it is they're talking about.
Well, this is true. I think there's a really incomplete understanding of what democracy means. But then on the other hand, if you just go out to some truck stop and in the middle of nowhere and you ask Americans what democracy is all about, you will get some pretty bizarre answers. I mean, it's a fairly sophisticated idea, so that one cannot expect the Chinese to have a very complete notion of it. But as we know, people don't need to understand things to fantasize about them and to idealize them. There's an expression in China, you know, tian tian guan yan, which means that every day, this is in reference to the United States, it's as if people were enjoying New Year's. In other words, the presumption is it's so rich, it's so exciting, people aren't working, there's such wealth. Well, there tends to be a similar, you know, this isn't the way it is here. We work hard, and life is miserable, and it's fun. We have all the whole gamut of possibilities. But the Chinese tend to look at democracy, looking sort of back at it, and not really understanding how complex it is, you know, how it can fail in many ways. People can be left out. I mean, how is it that the United States, with a democratic system, has so consistently got such mediocre presidents? Well, this is not a question the Chinese will ask. But they see it as some wonderful elixir that will solve all problems. And you talk to some of these students who are demonstrating, you know, you say, what is a bicameral legislature? What are checks and balances? Well, they're not sure. I mean, very basic things, but they still admire it. And you get to a country like China, which is poor and rather, still rather cut off from the outside. Oh, America does look dazzling indeed. I mean, we look like a tremendously seductive, exciting country. And many, many young Chinese think, you know, if I could only get there, mm-hmm. and there's tremendous interest now in coming to the United States, everything would be better. This is the promised land. And it creates a very interesting and often tragic kind of a situation when sometimes people do finally get here, and they find there's a whole new set of problems they've got to work out, because it is a real place, not simply a dreamland.
Yeah. One of the things you talk about in the book, and we've talked about, is the sort of blooming of private enterprise. And I was amazed that apparently everyone is getting into it to the extent that, is it really true that the Army developed a beauty cream and started selling that?
Well, yes, and I mean, the Army, which you would have once upon a time, you could not even photograph a soldier in the street. They were considered so hollow. This is as a foreigner, and you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, the Army was sacred, and everybody wanted to get in the Army, at like the party. Now, very few people care to get into the Army. It's considered to be a place where hicks go. And the Army, like other state enterprises, has in effect been told by the government, you want some good weapons, you want to have a nice barracks and good uniforms, go out and make money. And this doesn't mean they're not subsidized to some extent, but the Army has been told, get out and join production. So you see these kind of very curious, I saw one very funny scene. I was walking up to a little temple in the coastal town of Yantai in Shandong, and I saw two People's Liberation Army soldiers in uniform sitting with a camera on a card table in front of the temple. And I went up and I said, well, you know, afternoon guys, I said, what's up? You know, what brings you out here? And they were sort of smiled and giggled, and they said, well, we're taking pictures. And I said, taking pictures? I said, you got some friends here or something? They said, no, we're taking pictures for money. Would you like your picture taken? And what had happened was their unit had given them a camera and said, you know, go out and stand in front of that temple and make some money. So this is something that's being written larger and larger. The military is starting factories. It's retooling, you know, many of its operations to produce. Hmm. Not an entirely nutty idea, I might add. I mean, it's a good thing, I think, for the Army to think of itself as a cog in sort of civilian life in some respects. But this, I think, often gets carried to a kind of lunatic extreme.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what happened if we told the Pentagon they would have to go out and start earning some money.
Well, it might shape them up a bit. But, of course, the other side of all of this is as soon as the Army begins to enter into this business of private enterprise, you get a whole new avenue of corruption opened up. You get, Army officers who will be running whole confidence schemes and speculating and this is the other sort of aspect of these reforms, that as control has been diminished at the center, in the ministries in Peking, and as businesses have been told to work on their own more, you get a lot of officials scheming and standing in the way, taking protection and taking bribes. Incidentally, I might also tell you that two very capitalist institutions that have been introduced as a part of this loosening up, one is stock markets, which have appeared in a number of major cities now, a very capitalist institution, and why should the Chinese, who still profess to be socialists, adopt them? Well, because the government does not want to raise the money to make the proper capital investments in their own businesses. And so they have, in effect, just as they've told the Army to go out and raise money, they say, you go out and raise money. So you see state enterprises issuing stocks and bonds as a way to raise capital to improve their plants. And the other curious institution that's suddenly appeared is a bankruptcy law.
Mm-hmm.
You might say, what kind of a self-respecting socialist or communist country would believe in a bankruptcy law? Isn't the object of socialism to protect workers against greedy bosses who want to close down the factories and kick them out of their jobs? Again, we're reminded of the dispute in this country where Reagan vetoed the bill of the 60-day advance notice and factory closings. Chinese would point to that and say, aha, there's capitalism at work. Capitalists driving the workers out of the factory, they lose their jobs with no advance notice. But now we find the communists, so to speak, in China, when it doesn't dare call them communists anymore, doing exactly the same thing. They've promulgated a bankruptcy law, and why? Because the state wants to get rid of these businesses that don't make money, because they're state businesses, and they're just pulling the government under. They're making the government go bankrupt because they have to subsidize all these hopelessly out-of-date, badly run companies, factories that are making things that no one wants to buy. Well, here's another very classically capitalist institution that the socialist country has chosen to resurrect in its midst because its system just isn't working.
Mm-hmm. I like the turn of phrase you used to describe the visit of the man who's the head of the New York Stock Exchange to China, that he arrived there with his entourage. Yeah, Mr. Phelan. You said it was like the Pope landing in a remote third world country to bless a struggling local Catholic church. I like the image a lot.
Well, it's very, I must say, that we are like emissaries from the papacy here as China becomes more and more capitalist. We are, in essence, the center of the capitalist world. So our emissaries are very important, and the Chinese are very interested in learning.
Mm-hmm.
Who would ever have thought? But China is always a country that when it moves in with great in extremes. And just as it was very extremely egalitarian and socialist and anti-imperialist during Mao's time, now we find it sort of turning into its opposite, equal and opposite reaction, a kind of an extremism which, the party doesn't profess it, but intellectuals and students certainly are becoming rather extremely democratic in their frame of mind. And the reformers are becoming extremely capitalistic in their frame of mind. There's an expression in Chinese, which it's Wang Qian Kan, which during the Maoist period meant to look towards the future, with all your sort of heart and soul. But Wang, which means towards, and Qian, which means future, and Kan means look. Qian also means money. So they've just recycled this old Maoist adage, and now Wang Qian Kan means to look forward to getting rich or to money with all your heart and soul, a neat little play on words, an old slogan.
Yeah, I was thinking about how a number of years ago, someone in a parody of the Little Red Book, of the sayings of Chairman Mao that everyone once would carry around with them, collected some of the witticisms of Malcolm Forbes and did this parody that was the quotations of Chairman Malcolm. And somehow, as I was reading this book, I started thinking about Chinese going around. They're now reading quotations of Chairman Malcolm instead of quotations of Chairman Mao.
Well, you're not so far off, because you go down, you know, the street in cities like Peking and past all these bookstalls, and you see Li Iacocca has been translated. He is a big bestseller. I mean, you see, I might add, other books too, Lady Chatterley's Lover. You see a big boom in Sigmund Freud, which is very, very interesting, because, you know, really Freud is on the other end of the spectrum from Marx, namely, whereas Marx believes that society is the social unit, is the unit of importance. Freud believes the individual is, and that if there are problems, there are problems in the individual psyche. He represents a kind of a fixing of attention on the single person rather than all people together. And this is, again, part of this very important value change, where people are beginning to value themselves. They don't want to hear about politics. They don't want to hear about serving the people, about society as a whole, about sacrificing to the future. They want something for themselves now. Another artifact of this now sort of me generation is bodybuilding, which I have a whole section on, because, again, I think it's so emblematic of the shift in values.
Yeah.
This big controversy about when bodybuilding began to come back, whether women were to be allowed to wear bikinis. I mean, how can you have a bodybuilding competition if you can't see what kind of a body a woman has? She's certainly not going to show it to you in a Mao suit. So ultimately this got resolved and women were allowed to wear bikinis. Well, this was an extraordinary leap for China, because that was the one thing you weren't supposed to look at under Mao. You weren't supposed to fix on the physicality of a person. You were supposed to not even fix on a person. You were supposed to try to promote the welfare of society. And so here we have these lovely female comrades running around in bikinis at bodybuilding competitions, and postcards and calendars of them are appearing all over the country. And it represented, to me anyway, a kind of real, a kind of Chinese narcissism. A Chinese me generation. What was important was not building society, but building your own body. Just as fashion represented a fixation on the self and how one appears oneself, rather, in the Maoist lexicon, of how China as a nation appeared. So this was a dramatic change in value.
This morning on Focus 580, we're talking with Orville Schell, who has written a lot about China and the ways that it has changed since the revolution. He's the author of a number of books, and his articles have appeared in magazines such as The Atlantic Monthly, The New Yorker, and Rolling Stone. His newest book is entitled Discos and Democracy, China in the Throes of Reform, and it's published by Pantheon. We have a caller here who's been waiting patiently for a bit, and other folks are invited too if you have questions for us. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. Toll-free in Illinois, it's 800-222-9455. Well, let's talk with our caller here on line number one. Hello.
With other countries, they'd have to let some other stock exchanges in and value their currency according to the status of the world. So thereby allowing a mix of capitalism, and they'd have to start trading from there.
I may have missed the first part of that question.
Because China, if they want to trade with other countries, they have to let other stock exchanges into their country to put a value on their money, and therefore putting a value on its labor. So it's like the outside world can put a value on China's labor. Same.
Well, the problem now is with a country like China is that their money is what we call soft currency, and it's not desirable. In the outside market. Mm-hmm. So this I mean, ultimately, maybe China's currency could become a hard currency, but this is, I think the stock exchanges would not affect that in the short run. When you trade with China, you have to trade in a hard currency, in Japanese yen or dollars or something to that nature.
Okay.
But I think this is all part of their effort, you see, to develop an economy. Which, you know...
But don't you think that that would sacrifice some of their ideals while they're trying to develop a hard currency?
Well, I think it would, and I think this is just the problem. But there's a problem behind your question of doesn't it sacrifice ideals, and that is, what are their ideals? I mean, what are the ideals of a country that was a militantly socialist country and now is becoming a kind of a crypto-capitalist country? What do they believe in, capitalism or socialism? It's not clear.
But don't socialist countries in the world today have to pretty much go along with capitalism?
Well, I mean, it depends on...
Because no man is an island.
Well, no man is an island. And I think, sadly, in a certain way, they are discovering that it's very difficult to find your own kind of alternate way in the world market system if you don't, in some measure, fit into this whole world market system, which is run by the industrialized countries of the West. And I say sadly because I think it is, you know, often it would behoove these third world countries to find some way that was more sort of satisfactory to them.
Yeah.
But they are forced, and I think this is the tragedy of China in a way, is at first that they went in such an extreme fashion in favor of this Russian ideology, German ideology, Marxist-Leninism. And now you find them really throwing the baby out with the bathwater, that the Maoist revolution was very brutal and had, in many ways, was just a ghastly failure. But in certain ways, it was a great success. I mean, there are certain accomplishments which are undeniable. But sadly, we now see China throwing these out, too. Among them, for instance, would be, you know, universal health care, a good fight against literacy, a fairly decent educational system in the countryside, things of this nature, you know, good, reasonable control of the rivers that used to flood China regularly, large-scale projects to reclaim land. These things are going to be very difficult given this new system stressing the individual, private enterprise, and things of that nature.
Do you deal with that at all? Any solutions to that?
Well, I talk about it at some length in my book. It's really, in essence, what the book is about, trying to figure out, you know, what should a country do that decides it doesn't like who it is, that wants to change its nature, and is it really possible for a country to suddenly and precipitously change its nature and its system?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's not. I think ultimately you end up with terrible instability, and, you know, something on the order of Iran is liable to happen.
Oh, I don't know.
Well, I mean, that's the extreme. But what I mean to say is that these changed identities, when done at the top, can have a kind of a boomerang effect sometimes. No, I don't predict this for China in the near future anyway, but it's very difficult for a country which knows so little who it is that it's constantly trying to try on new identities as if they're just clothes off the rack. And there's a bit of that going on in China now, and it's quite unsettling. Just one of the things which we see a lot of in China is cosmetic surgery, because Chinese now want to look more Western. That is a kind of an emblem of what I mean.
Yeah.
That even the notion of what is beautiful...
I don't think that's on a widespread basis.
Oh, it's quite widespread, and there didn't used to be any of it. And you find young people really identifying with beauty in the Western sense now, right from fashion to how their bodies and faces look.
Mm.
It's a very unclear, there's a very unclear notion about what is beautiful in a Chinese sense. And it's a result of American movies and television and tourists and students and, you know, the power of our pop culture.
Okay, well, thanks for the answer.
All right, well, thank you. We we'll be here for maybe about 10 minutes longer. We're talking with Orville Schell about his recent book, Discos and Democracy. It does seem as if there is something of an identity crisis, if that's the right kind of word to use, going on in China with this kind of headlong rush to embrace Western popular culture and all the way up to people who are willing to pay what for them probably is a fair amount of money to have their noses changed and have their eyes made more round and all of those things that when Westerners came to the Orient were such objects of such derision. I mean, now they're actually, you know, they're transforming themselves into Western barbarians, and it all seems very, very strange.
Well, I think we started off, you know, sort of talking about how when countries become more like us, we as Americans tend to think that they are straightening out. But here is a case in the most sort of graphic way in which Chinese young people are seeking to become more like us. And it's not a salutary, kind of a phenomena. It's exactly generates the kind of self-doubt, or speaks of the kind of self-doubt, and generates the kind of self-loathing, which in the past in China has ended very badly because it's led to anti-foreignism, a kind of a humiliation. And whenever China has felt that it has suffered by comparison to the West, that it has appeared weaker or unable to defend itself or undesirable, it reacts because it's a very proud country. And traditionally speaking, Chinese are used to being a culture and society of consequence, of even grand consequence, and to find themselves so off balance that their economic system, their political system, and even their kind of system of aesthetics are more and more becoming Western. It's a bad place, psychologically speaking, for them to be in. You could deal with it in an individual way, too, and speak in psychological terminology. So, I mean, I do think that there's cause for worry that this whole change, this sort of slavish worship of the West, what the Chinese call it is a kind of a mentality where people believe the moon is rounder in the West than in China, even the moon.
Mm-hmm.
It is a mentality, not an actuality often. And this is not, I think, finally, it will help China manage itself, it will help China get capital, joint ventures, it will help in this way, but the underlying sense of itself, its national identity, I think may be seriously compromised because it's losing its capacity to resist its own sort of native immune system is being compromised.
It seems that in the years immediately following the Cultural Revolution, once the Gang of Four was brought down and things began to open up, it seemed that when you talked with people, they were quite excited and at the same time very cautious because they sort of felt that things could go back to the way they were almost at any moment. And I wonder, do people still have that sense that somehow all of this, what seems to be dramatic change, could come apart at any time? Or has enough time passed since then, you know, it's been about, I guess, about 10 years or so, has enough time passed so that people have forgotten that?
Well, I think the government constantly is telling them that the reforms are eternal, that there is no going back. And I think in many ways they're right. For instance, all the people's communes and collectivized agriculture have been destroyed, and all the land, they've been dismantled under the reforms, and all the land, rural land, has been chopped up into small pieces and leased out to family farms to be farmed privately. Well, there's no returning to the communes. That's over. We are now in a country with hundreds of millions of private family farms. On the other hand, there is still, as we talked about earlier, a split within the leadership. And there are two very sort of different notions about how fast these reforms should go forward and how much should be thrown out of the old system. So people are wary. And it only takes a slight shock, a few statements about counter-revolutionaries, a few, you know, people talking about the dangers of too much capitalism to put a scare into this whole system of reform. And periodically we do get these statements by these old, these hardliners who are not thrilled with the way they see crime increasing, with young kids dressing up and looking crazy, the way in which private enterprise is running wild, that the country's been racked by corruption and student demonstrations. And this means that the party has to be very careful about the kind of statements it makes of a malice nature, because when too many are made, people start hiding their money in their mattress, they don't produce, the students who are in this country get wary about coming home, you get a whole chain reaction of fear. And that's why right now the party's taking such a soft line with Chinese intellectuals, many of whom have made some fairly outrageous statements about the communism. Is this one man, the astrophysicist Fang Lijie, who's in effect China's Andrei Sakharov, has said that Chinese socialism is like an old dress that's so worn out it should be thrown away. Well, he was kicked out of the party and lost his job as vice president of China's MIT, but they haven't done anything else to him, and they don't want to persecute him or send him down to the Chinese gulag, because to do that would send a scare through all other intellectuals, and they would stop working and stop creating, and China's reform movement and whole effort towards modernization would be seriously impaired. So the party's in a terrible bind. On the one hand, they want to modernize. On the other hand, they want to keep control. But they can't crack down too much, because people remember the Cultural Revolution too well, and it sets a scare into the whole system, which will be antithetical to their whole reform interests. So people do remember.
I have a couple of callers here. I don't know if we can get them both in, but I'd like to make sure we get at least one in here. Let's go to line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I just thought that was real curious about how the a number of young people, apparently quite a few, feel that they need to change themselves physically. I recall something similar happening, reading about Japan when it was being occupied after World War II. And, I mean, it still happens here as today when people, especially women, try to change themselves to meet a certain image. And I think that's a really, really terrible thing. And I think what it does lead to is exactly what the gentleman you're interviewing is saying, is that eventually you blow up in the other direction. And I wonder why it is that there are these swings between such an adherent to one external, i.e. imported, i.e. European extreme, which was Marxism, okay, which is a European thing, all right? It's not third world. And then coming back to the other way, another European thing, which is capitalism and certain other aspects of freer abilities to do a variety of things, instead of finding somewhere in between. I don't know how much of that is external pressure, how much of that is...
Well, I think very little. I think, you know, you've put your finger on the real crux of the matter, and my understanding is that, you know, any individual or society, when they really don't know who they are, when they aren't grounded in any kind of self-belief, tend to veer off from one side to the other, trying to find some new kind of off-the-rack identity to try on. And I think that's what we see in China, a real sense of self-doubt of what it means to be Chinese or Chinese communist, and thus this kind of propensity for experimentation with outside identities to see if they don't fit. And, of course, if you abandon one, Chinese communism, easily, you may abandon the other equally as easily when that proves to be terribly complicated and difficult to adopt, namely these experimentations with Western capitalism and, to a lesser extent, with the ideas of democracy, Western democracy.
Let me, I hope the caller will forgive me. I want to try and get this one last person here before we must finish up here on line number two. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I was wondering whether your book addresses the one-child family policy in China.
Yes. Well, that's a real thorny one, because in a way you see all these reforms, particularly in the countryside, where family farming is now the unit of production, has put tremendous emphasis on having big families. So these draconian measures that the party has tried to take to keep one family, each family only having one child, have really only been successful in the city. In the countryside, they've had real problems. So they've got a contradiction going here. They've got to get on top of their population problem. And yet, the political, the economic reforms, which are emphasizing the family as the new unit, mean that people want to have big families. Moreover, as the communes and the collectivized aspects of life are dismantled, the old welfare system, which used to take care of old people, is being dismantled. And so people want more children. That's the new form of welfare in the countryside. So this is where the battle will be won or lost, because 80% of the people of China live in the countryside. And at the same time, the party has really lost, is losing more and more control in the countryside, because whereas people were easy to control in communes, they were all together and organized, it's very difficult to control, you know, 800 million ball bearings rolling around in no organized institutional context. So the party is not able to exert the kind of pressure that it once was on women to have one child, and indeed peasant woman gets pregnant with her second or third child, and maybe she has a daughter and wants a son, she'll just leave the village, and she'll come back 6-7 months later with the baby born, a fait accompli.
We will have to leave it at that. I wish we had more time, but we have simply used up our allotment. Thank you very much for talking with us. It's really been pleasant.
It's been fun. Thank you.